This podcast includes graphic descriptions of sexual assault. It may not be suitable for all listeners.
So one thing that I want to do is pick out the color. Okay, I'm just trying to figure out what color I want to use as a base. Sorry, it's taking me a minute.
This is Maria Farmer. She's standing in front of a large wooden easel in her living room slash art studio. The room is open and airy, flooded with light from floor-to-ceiling windows that overlook a beautiful lake out front.
So we're in my studio. It's a new studio for me. It's very well lit, which is such a treat. And so I'm taking advantage of that for a couple reasons. One thing for this series, I really want it to be vibrant.
Maria is working with a new set of soft pastels, thumbing through a wooden box for the perfect base color to use in a portrait that she's drawing.
I want to draw people's attention to it. And I also feel like there's a lot of strength and power in this, you know, being very colorful.
Once on the path to a promising art career, only in recent years has Maria been able to stand before an easel again.
It's just, I'm trying to do all these different primaries. Maybe I'll just do green again.
The portrait she's working on is part of a series. On the wall next to her are seven others that make up what she's calling the Survivors Project. Seven portraits, all different women, each one of them with piercing eyes set on top of bright, vibrant hues.
There's turquoise, there's pink, there's purple, there's yellow, there's blue, there's green and orange. And so that's each color behind the girl represents her.
Each one of the women, survivors of Jeffrey Epstein.
On the left is Sarah, and then you have Virginia, and then Michelle.
I want these girls to be honored individually.
I wanted it to portray how beautiful these women are and how strong they are.
But there is one portrait that's missing, Maria's.
I'm going to be a blank sheet of paper in mine.
She says she, too, is a survivor of Jeffrey Epstein. But there's a reason why she'll simply be a blank canvas.
I am just a blank sheet of paper, according to the U.S. government and the FBI. And I have felt like a blank sheet of paper for 24 years. That's how I feel. I feel invisible.
That's because well before authorities in Florida would investigate Jeffrey Epstein and his system designed to bring him underage girls, Maria Farmer says she tried to sound the alarm.
If the FBI had listened to me in 1996 when I called them and gave them all the details about the perpetrators and their crimes up to that point, if they had listened at all and cared,
none of the women would have been harmed if the FBI had done their job.
A decade before more than a dozen young girls and women in Palm Beach would share their stories of abuse at Epstein's mansion, Maria Farmer would speak up first. She says she told the NYPD and the FBI about Jeffrey Epstein, who she says wedged himself into her life, into her career, even into her family.
Maria told me that he was a very generous person who liked to help academically gifted students. And he also was very interested in furthering her art career.
He definitely was manipulating us.
And she alleges that Epstein, along with his one-time girlfriend, Ghislaine Maxwell, would take advantage of her.
She sold it to me. I mean, like hook, line, and sinker. I thought this woman really cared.
And even when she spoke up, Maria says nothing happened.
I gave them everything they needed, all the bad actors. The FBI has known about this. And that's why when I look at those other girls, they were ruined too. And I can see it. We're all broken.
From ABC News, I'm Mark Remillard. And this is Truth and Lies, Jeffrey Epstein. Chapter 2, I Tried to Warn You.
So, Carlos, this...
So where am I going?
I'll talk to you in a second.
Jim, am I just sitting?
Yeah,
just sitting. Okay.
It's now September 2019, and Maria Farmer has spent 18 hours in a car to be here in New York City.
Thank you for sitting down with us.
Absolutely.
So you're just going to look at me
okay. And
try to ignore the fact.
She's driven with two close friends, as well as ABC News senior producer and our lead reporter, James Hill, all the way from Kentucky. Maria had to drive the 1,200 miles to get here because a brain tumor prevents her from flying.
Sure. Okay, my name is Maria Farmer.
She's here in New York, where she lived 25 years ago, to tell us about how she came to meet Jeffrey Epstein. At the time, she says she was in her mid-20s, pursuing her dreams of becoming an artist, something her mother, Janice Swain, says Maria had wanted since she was a child.
Maria was born to be an artist. She was coloring pictures on her crib sheets when she was just a baby. By the time she was 2 years old, she was drawing very recognizable characters. By the time she was 3 years old, she had her own easel and table and art room.
And just as much as Maria wanted to be an artist, she wanted to be one in New York.
She also went to New York when she was about five and decided right then that she would grow up to be an artist and live in New York.
Actually, I have my journal over there that says, when I grow up, I have the potential to be a great artist. And I wrote that when I was in the third grade. So I also put, when I grow up, I would like to move to New York and study painting.
Maria would get that chance in 1993 after she heard about a graduate program in New York to study art.
I just knew I was going to go there and study painting. And so I just told everyone I'd gotten into graduate school and I went there so nobody would be worried. And I moved there with $14.
Soon, she was living in the heart of New York City.
Yeah, it was the best thing that ever happened to me. I lived on Barrow Street in Greenwich Village. I was so proud of it. I'd like swing my keys walking up to the stoop. I wanted everyone to know I live here.
And she says she would spend a lot of time in museums.
It was just about being near the museums and being near all these great artists and learning from them and being able to study with them and being able to, oh my gosh, study from these great paintings. Most cities you can't go and just look at a Degas or, you know, a Vermeer and then go home and implement that. And that city had so much energy in the arts back then, especially. Manhattan was really energetic.
She'd eventually come to get the scholarship she'd need to attend the New York Academy of Art.
It was just her dream was being realized when she was able to attend the academy. She did want to go to New York more than anywhere else.
It was all coming together for Maria. She had the talent and she was getting the education and the support that she needed. The one thing she didn't have was money. With a rigorous academic schedule and multiple jobs, Maria was burning the candle at both ends.
Pretty much painted 12 hours a day, and then I worked all these side jobs.
But by 1995, after 2 years at the academy, her art career was picking up steam, and success came quickly.
I was selling my paintings for over $20,000 out of my studio. Nothing was going to stop me. I just knew I was going to be an art star, and everyone knew it around me. It was really strange.
Her hard work and round-the-clock painting was building toward one pivotal event, her thesis show. For a whole year, she'd been working on three paintings as part of a series based on Lewis Carroll's Through the Looking Glass. And in May 1995, she debuted them in an art show set up by the New York Academy of Art. And Maria's work was a hit.
All three of my paintings sold the night of the opening. People just walking by came in. A guy who was a director from Los Angeles, he loved it. He bought one. Another guy was German, and he bought two paintings, and they were at $12,000 apiece.
It was shaping up to be an incredible evening for the young artist. But little did she know, it would also be a life-changing event. Because it was during this art show that she says she was introduced to a man and a woman whom she was told were important patrons in the art world.
He looked kind of distinguished because he had gray hair, and he always had this smirk, like he knew something that the other people didn't know. So he was always wearing this little smirk, but not in a really intimidating way or a rude way. It was almost like inviting you to ask him, what are you thinking about right now? And he went to shake my hand and he said, you're so talented. I love your painting. But here's the thing. You're going to give us a discount because we're not going to pay full price, but we're going to make it up to you.
That man was Jeffrey Epstein. And the woman, Farmer says, it was socialite, Ghislaine Maxwell.
Ghislaine Maxwell, she always had very short hair. She had a style that was sort of Upper East Side flashy, tassels. She had kind of an androgynous look. She didn't wear a lot of makeup. She wasn't beautiful, but she had this way of charming everyone with her words and her voice.
You mentioned the way she talked, the Queen's English. Is
right. Yes, she had the Queen's English.
Very elegant. I mean, she
very eloquent. Right. Extraordinarily well-educated.
Maria says she would end up taking back one of the paintings she previously sold to instead sell it to Epstein for half the price. It's a powerful piece. The viewer is looking through a doorway into a room with deep shadows in the foreground and illuminating light in the background. The doorway makes almost a frame within a frame. In the background, there's a woman in a purple dress, lost in thought on an antique couch.
So that was me sitting there in a contemplative manner, lying there on the sofa.
And I'm fully clothed. I'm in the back, tiny on the sofa, but I'm, you know, a real size. But the viewer sees me as small.
There's a red carpet that rolls across the floor to a man standing in the foreground.
A man entering through the doorway.
His back is to you, and he's wearing nothing but white boxers. You can't see his face.
And it's just an imaginary man.
But you can see that he's leering at the woman as she lies on the couch. Not long after the art show, Maria received a call. It was Epstein on the line, and he said that he had a job for her.
And he said to me, "Maria, meet me tomorrow morning at the office, and I'll explain the job to you." I'm thrilled, right? I think, oh, wow, this is great.
So the next morning, Maria made her way here. I'm standing on the corner of 50th Street and Madison Avenue in the heart of Midtown Manhattan. And this is where Jeffrey Epstein had his offices, at 457 Madison Avenue, a beautiful, historic stone building. This is the same building as the historic Hemsley Palace and the Villard houses, and it is directly across from one of the most regal churches in all of New York City, St. Patrick's Cathedral.
I get all the way up there, and the office staff seem really nice. Seemed like a real office. You know, people are answering phones. There were women in there typing, and people all jovial and smiling at me, and they all knew my name, and I walked.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
In the summer of 1996, Maria was still working for Epstein and painting in her free time when she was given a big opportunity to provide some artwork for a feature film. She couldn't work for Epstein and complete her art, so she told Epstein she was quitting.
I had told him that I got this job, and I was really honored. It was really exciting for me. And I thought, man, I'm going to pour my heart out into these paintings. So I quit. And I said, "Jeffrey, I'm turning in my notice. I'll be here another 2 weeks." I was being polite. And he said, No. "I'm so sorry you're unhappy with this. Oh my gosh. I want you to be happy, Maria."
That's when she says Epstein insisted that she go to Ohio to paint. That's where Epstein had a home he acquired in 1992. And Maria says that Epstein told her it was situated on the massive estate of his client, Les Wexner.
Epstein said, "Great, you could do the paintings at Les Wexner's."
A statement from a spokesperson for Les Wexner says that the home was not on land owned by the Wexners, and property records show that the home sits adjacent to Wexner's estate. Maria wasn't sold on the idea, but she says that Epstein insisted, saying it would be a great place for her to work.
Ohio? Are you kidding me? I had a boyfriend in New York. I didn't want to leave and go to Ohio. They said, listen, you'll have more light there, tons of space, right? We'll pay for your supplies.
So Maria agrees to go and arrives at Epstein's home in New Albany, Ohio, an affluent suburb of Columbus. The home sits on acres of land, tucked away from the main roads, just to the north of Les Wexner's sprawling estate and 30-room mansion.
And as soon as we get there, you know, we pull in and there's this beautiful estate. We're driving forever on it. We pass the stables that are being built in this mansion.
Wexner's estate is massive. His home sits in the center of 360 acres of land with stables and evergreen hedgerows. And a little more than a third of a mile away sits the 10,000-square-foot house then owned by Jeffrey Epstein.
And then we get around to the front to this neoclassical, tacky home, right? Tacky because it's, again, like, not old, but trying to be old. And these huge columns, just kind of over the top.
Maria says when she arrives, she's greeted by a member of Wexner's security. She says he tells her that if she needs anything, to contact him or Abigail Wexner, Les Wexner's wife. And Maria says he gave her a warning. There's armed security on the property, and it's patrolled by dogs.
So you can't go outside at all unless you get our permission.
In the 2 months that Maria stayed on the property, she says she never met Les or Abigail Wexner, but says she did speak on the phone with Abigail Wexner a few times.
When I first got to the property, Abigail did call me to thank me for coming to do this artist in residency. She said we're huge supporters of the arts.
In a statement, a spokesperson for the Wexners said that until recent news coverage, both Leslie and Abigail Wexner had never heard of Maria. And the spokesperson added that they have never met Maria, never spoken with her, and adds that they never spoke about Maria to Epstein. Epstein's home would seem to provide the space that Maria needed to work. Maria says that Epstein told her she'd have more time to relax, that she'd be able to play tennis or golf in her free time, that she'd eat food from the nearby country clubs. But she says none of those things happened, and instead, she says she felt isolated and controlled. She says she often felt like she had to stay inside Epstein's home, even taking her runs for exercise indoors. And feeling like a prisoner, Maria says she got little work done. According to Maria's lawsuit, at one point, Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell came to Ohio for a visit and stayed at the home with Maria. And it was during this visit that Maria says everything changed. It began when Epstein requested that Maria give him a foot massage. Maria was in her room when she says she was summoned by Maxwell.
Knock, knock, knock. It's Ghislaine Maxwell. She knocks on the door and she said, Maria, we need you for just a minute.
She says Maxwell was in a robe and that struck her as unusual.
It was like I knew something was up.
She walked down the hall to Epstein's room and there on the bed was Epstein lying in his socks and boxers.
And I knew. I knew I was in trouble.
Maria says she felt uncomfortable. This was her boss.
I've never rubbed my boss's feet. So I'm like, I don't think I'm very good at this. And he goes, sit right here. And it was actually over here. Sit right here. And I thought, oh, God.
That's when, in her lawsuit, Maria says that Ghislaine Maxwell and Jeffrey Epstein proceeded to violently sexually assault her.
And I sat down, and Ghislaine got on the other side of me, and they proceeded to touch me, and I don't remember the assault. I remember being in a lot of pain. I remember having some bruises. I don't remember everything they touched, but they didn't get my clothes off. They tried. And at one point, I started to cry a little bit. And she grabbed my hand and she goes, it's okay. It's okay. And she's like reassuring me and, you know, rubbing my face. And it was sickening to me. What's happening? I was in an absolute panic to the point where I was able to get myself up and get out of that room. And Ghislaine came after me. But I literally took these big pieces of furniture and I pushed them against the doors. And I stayed up all night.
Terrified. Maria says she barricaded herself in her room and claims she called police for help, but to no avail. Maria is not sure which police agency she spoke with, and we've attempted to find out if there are any records of Maria's call. The New Albany Police Department says it doesn't retain 911 records going back to the 1990s,
and attempts to find records at other local departments were unsuccessful. Maria stayed in her room all night, and by the next day when she emerged, she says Epstein and Maxwell were gone. They'd already left to return to New York, and it was later in the day that she says she got a call from Epstein.
He said, Maria, I will do whatever you want. I am so sorry. What can I give you? I will give you any amount of money. He offered to do anything. The man would have given me millions of dollars. And I hung up on him. Are you kidding me? What is this? Why would you touch me like that? I'm your employee. There was no amount of money. Nothing. No, we weren't going to talk.
Maria knew she needed to leave. She says she was worried about her safety, but says in her lawsuit that one of Wexner's security guards stood in her way and that she was held on the property for several hours against her will.
When Maria called me, she was crying and she was very upset, obviously very upset from what had happened to her.
Her mother, Janice Swain, remembers getting a frantic phone call from Maria.
I was actually in Germany at the time Maria called me to tell me that she was at the Wexner estate and that something had happened with Gilan and Jeffrey. Because I was out of the country, I couldn't even imagine how I could help her. So she reached out to her father and he did come to the estate.
Maria's lawsuit says she was finally allowed to leave after her father arrived at the property. He'd driven from his home in Kentucky to Ohio to get her. In a statement to ABC News, a Wexner spokesperson said that Maria's allegations of being held on the property against her will are, quote, contrary to the professional obligations of the security team. After leaving the property, Maria says she wanted nothing to do with Epstein or Maxwell, but says she'd soon find out that being free of them would not be so easy. Upon returning to New York, Maria claims in court documents that she would receive threatening phone calls from Maxwell on behalf of Epstein.
I get a call from Ghislaine Maxwell telling me that all of my art is going to be burned. It has been burned. Anything I ever make will be burned. My home will burn. I will die. And she would say it like, be careful when you walk around. I know you like to go running on the West Side Highway, so just watch over your back because you know what? You can get killed a lot of ways on the West Side Highway.
We attempted to reach Ghislaine Maxwell as part of our reporting for this story, but her lawyers did not respond to requests for comment. Despite the threats, Maria decided she would go to the police.
And I was dreading it, because how do you tell someone I was living on this estate, couldn't go outside for 3 months, but I stayed there? You know, how do you tell people this? It's so creepy and bizarre. And who's going to believe me?
On August 29th, 1996, at the 6th Precinct of the New York City Police Department, just 1 year after meeting Jeffrey Epstein, Maria filed the earliest known police report against him. Much of the report is redacted, but it mentions that Maria was afraid that Epstein would burn her paintings and send her Polaroids of the ashes. It also says that Epstein had keys to her apartment.
They weren't dismissive, but they did laugh a little bit. They thought it was kind of a funny story. And they said, oh, come on, you know. And they said, you know what? They realized, we can't handle this. We can file a report for you about art theft or whatever you want.
Maria's lawsuit says she was told by the NYPD that they couldn't do anything about the alleged sexual assault in Ohio and that they referred her to the FBI. So Maria says she called the FBI later that very day.
I gave them everything they needed to know. The very people I was reporting, very powerful.
But then she says nothing happened.
Well, I think no one listening was frustrating for her.
We asked the FBI if they had any record of Maria's 1996 report, but as a matter of policy, the FBI declined to comment and it wouldn't confirm or deny whether any record exists. Maria tells us it took one evening for the course of her life to change. She'd gone from living her dream as an artist in New York, pulling in $20,000 commissions, to someone who wouldn't even pick up a brush.
She was threatened and she was afraid. She suddenly didn't want to live in New York anymore. She changed her name a couple of times just because she was afraid. She was more reclusive, I think.
Back at her home, as we're sitting in her art studio, she told our lead reporter, James Hill, that it's taken her a long time to finally be able to talk about what happened to her.
And so I stopped painting from that time period of like the early 2000s until a year ago. And really, I was just kind of going through the motions of life. So not painting for 20 years it caused me to have depression, and it was very painful. I'm trying not to cry. So yeah, it was just very painful to not be able to paint and to not do the one thing that I was here to do. And I feel like I have a lot of catching up to do because, you know, it's been so long. So I have a great deal of work that I need to accomplish.